Welcome to STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
Welcome to STEM Talk, where we introduce you to fascinating people who passionately inhabit the scientific and technical frontiers of our society. Hi, I'm your host, Don Cornegus, and joining me to introduce today's podcast is the man behind the curtain, Dr. Ken Ford, IHMC's director and chairman of the double secret selection committee that selects all the guests who appear on STEM Talk.
Hi, Don. Great to be here with you today.
Our guest today is Dr. Emma Wilson, a professor of biomedical science with the University of California Riverside School of Medicine. She is a native of Scotland, and for more than 15 years, she has been studying Toxoplasma gondii, which is a protozoan parasite found in all mammals that infects about a third of the world's human population. Her 2016 research paper in the online journal PLOS Pathogens connected the single-celled organism to brain dysfunction. But before we get to today's interview with Emma, we have some housekeeping to take care of. First, we really appreciate all of you who have subscribed to STEM Talk, and we are especially appreciative of all the wonderful 5-star reviews. As always, the Double Secret Selection Committee has been continually and carefully reviewing iTunes, Google, Stitcher, and other podcast apps for the wittiest and most lavishly praise-filled reviews to read on STEM Talk. As always, if you hear your review read on STEM Talk, just contact us at stemtalk@ihmc.us to claim your official STEM Talk t-shirt.
Today, our winning review was posted by someone who goes by the moniker Wyo Hiker. I think that means Wyoming Hiker. We believe this to be a repeat winner, and that's okay. You can win more than once. Wyo Hiker had some nice things to say about our recent Ask Me Anything episodes. The review reads, "Truly wonderful episodes with Ken and Don bringing personal insights to the world of science and life in general. Their two Ask Me Anything podcasts are critically important for many reasons, but in particular because they demonstrate how and why the pursuit of science and asking questions is truly a human endeavor. Ken and Don and their many guests on STEM Talk bring to life very complicated and often complex topics simply by letting us listeners gain a little insight into the people and personalities behind the science. I finish listening to each new STEM Talk, wishing I could be in their lab, involved in their research, working with good, dedicated people who love what they do."
Well, we wish you were here too, Wyo Hiker. Thank you for another wonderful review, and thank you to all the other STEM Talk listeners who helped STEM Talk become such a great success.
Okay, and now on to today's interview with Dr. Emma Wilson.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
Talk. STEM Talk.
Hi, welcome to STEM Talk. I'm your host, Don Cornegus, and joining us today is Emma Wilson. Emma, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Don. It's wonderful to be here.
And also joining us is Ken Ford.
Great to be here, Don, and welcome, Emma.
Thank you, Ken. It's great to be here, too.
So, Emma, you grew up in Glasgow, and I understand that your parents were in the acting business. So what was that like?
Yes, my dad was an actor, but he was also a radio drama producer for a long time. My parents met when my mom was a wardrobe mistress in the theatre. My dad was playing Caesar or something. So I don't want to think about that too deeply, but it was definitely not in the science world, although my parents were great readers. They both are. And my dad especially loved a lot of science.
So as a child, your father advised you to keep all of your doors in life open. And as a result, you wanted to do everything, which I understand. Is that right?
I remember being at high school and having to decide what subjects we have to take and really finding it very hard to put down things like techie drawing and arts and crafts, but realizing maybe my strengths weren't in that area. And so I had to put them down eventually. And so instead I took all three sciences and at higher and found my way that way. So I think that's a good advice for everyone. There's a lot of STEM education now, and really hope that kids get to find something that they love rather than feel that science is the answer to everything.
I agree with you on that. And when it came time to start applying for university, it was also the start of what was known as the Green Movement. So can you talk about how you decided to major in ecology because you wanted to save the rainforest?
Yes, I had possibly a very naive, simplified view of the world at the time. It was the early 90s and lots of, you know, recycling logos and lots of information about the rainforests and how they were being depleted. And growing up in Glasgow, we had a lot of choices for good universities, but I decided to go to Dundee to do evolutionary biology and ecology, thinking that I would save the rainforests. But but although ecology is very, it's coming back into being very useful in many fields with things like the microbiome. But I realized a lot of it is sort of mathematical modeling, and I wasn't about to save any rainforests very quickly.
But then you ran into the proverbial crazy professor who asked you if you could keep a secret. And as I understand it, he opened a door and showed you a room full of rattlesnakes. Now, that is an odd professor. Can you talk about that and the role that this experience played in helping you develop an interest in immunology?
Yeah, I'm not sure what those Iacocc protocols must have looked like for rattlesnakes, but he happened to be the professor that was taking a group of us prospective students around the university, and he opened this door, and all these rattlesnakes went crazy. And and it turns out he studies a parasite called the pentastomid, which is a yucky, really yucky parasite, which has a very thick cuticle and lives in the bellies of rattlesnakes. And it turns out in the nostrils of reindeers. I'm not quite sure how that works out. But he was a classic parasitologist where he went off to interesting, dark and scary places and infected himself, we think, with all sorts of, and got it through customs that way. But he was also a very inspiring lecturer, and he taught me the basics. I think there was 8 of us in the class, and he taught us the basics of helminths versus protozoa and type 1 versus type 2 immune response. And yeah, I realized that I wanted to know some more. So it took me some time to get a PhD position, though.
Interesting. I have a hard time actually believing the story I heard about you, but that I understand that you traveled to Tanzania to do research and that you are actually paid to stand out in the bush so mosquitoes could have a feast on you. Is that even close to right?
Well, it's not quite right.
Good.
The part about standing outside being fed upon was actually midges in the west of Scotland, which are terrifying beasts, terrifying, and it keeps the tourists down. But you get these clouds and clouds of midges that bite you. But the mosquitoes I investigated in Tanzania, and a similar research project for both of these insects, were interested to see the olfactants that attracted the insects to their breeding areas. And so I went around in Tanzania in a small place called Muheza with the London School of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene and sampled water from various swamps and breeding grounds. I didn't speak much Swahili, but I tried to teach them some Scottish at the same time. We swapped.
That
it was
would
a really
be
interesting time.
An interesting sight to see.
Yes.
It's kind of interesting, as I understand it, you were there in Africa, as you explained to us just now. And this is a place with some of the world's largest and most impressive animals. And did you see any of those, or were you limited to mosquitoes? Well-fed mosquitoes.
Yes, very well-fed mosquitoes. Unfortunately, I didn't see anything bigger than a well-fed mosquito on the inside of my mosquito net. I was a poor student, so couldn't afford to go off and do the safari after the research. So I stuck to well-fed bloody mosquitoes, which was unfortunate.
Oh, boy.
That's the alternative.
Yeah, we arrived in Dar es Salaam, and when we told people where we were going, which was the north, we're, you know, studying these mosquitoes, they looked at us very, very worried. And you know, because people that get bitten are, you know, they have 90% chance of being infected by Plasmodium. So they were very concerned that we were taking all the proper precautions. So I took some drugs. I took all my anti-malarials.
That's good. So, Emma, you came back from Africa and actually sold popcorn at a movie theater and did some other odd jobs before you wrote a letter to Dr. William Harnett at the University of Strathclyde about your interest in immunology and parasitology. So can you tell us a little bit about that letter and then also what happened next?
Yes, I did lots of little odd jobs. Really still wanted to be in parasitology. So I wrote a little letter, and I remember writing it in my bedroom up in an attic. And it was a letter you might write to your granny, you know, a little bit of paper. And I remember squeezing in at the bottom at some point, TH1 and TH2. And it was the most unprofessional letter you could probably ever write. But maybe it got across my love and desire to follow parasitology. And serendipity, I think, it plays a huge role in science. And I was fortunate that Billy Harnett had access to some money for a PhD student at the time, and he called me in for an interview. So it's gone very well since then.
That's fantastic. And I agree about serendipity in research. So can you tell us a little bit about the research that you were doing?
Yeah. So when I was at Dundee doing my undergrad with this classic crazy parasitologist, he gave me papers on helminths and the molecules that they secrete. And a lot of these papers were from Billy Harnett. And we studied a molecule called ES62 that is secreted by a filarial nematode called Acanthocoela pneumovitii, which is a model for onchocerciasis. And this worm secretes this one molecule, which you can see on an SDS page. And it does lots of amazing things like modulate our immune system. So these filarial worms can exist in the human host for many, many years, you know, up to 30 years, people have documented. And yet they're not tiny, you know, intracellular organisms. These are worms that you can see by the naked eye, and they're in areas that your immune response should really be able to deal with them. So the idea is that they secrete these molecules to dampen down the immune response and allow them to hang out for a very long time. So I studied that molecule and how it modulates the immune response.
So you had the opportunity to attend a conference in Philadelphia where you met a lot of interesting people, and mostly in a bar, which I understand you believe is very important in scientific place, and I think we agree with you on that. Can you tell us about the conference and how you ended up spending the next 5.5 years at the University of Pennsylvania?
Actually, yes. So my first time to the States was actually a conference in Woods Hole, and I imagine many people know Woods Hole very well, and I'm very fond of it. And it's there that I met a researcher who was at the University of Pennsylvania. So this conference was the Woods Hole Immunoparasitology Conference, otherwise known as WIP. As you know, the bar is a very important place. And I thought this conference was amazing. I didn't realize so many people worked on immunoparasitology. And at the bar, I got introduced to all of these people by a guy called Jim Alexander, who was at Strathclyde with me. He was the chair of my department, and he was very supportive and encouraging. And this guy, Chris Hunter, knew him very well and said, would you be interested in coming down, having a look around Philly? And I didn't consider this as an interview. I thought he was just being generous. He had nothing else to do for the next couple of days. I was going to go back up to Boston and do something touristy. So instead, I'll go investigate Philadelphia. And he was very generous, and I stayed with him and his wife and his little baby, who horrifically now is at university. And that's about time, not the fact that she's at university. And then he showed me around the lab, which was not really showing me around the lab and looking at tips and pipettes. He gave me interviews with people in the department, including Phil Scott, David Artis, Jay Farrell. And it was a really great day. And then I don't know what he saw in me, because my training was limited in immunology and not much better in parasitology, but he invited me to join his lab.
That's fantastic. Well, while you were in Philadelphia, you were sent to a conference in California, and once again, you got the chance to meet several fantastic scientists, but you kind of stood out at the conference because you sat in the back of the room and asked so many questions that people started turning around and asking each other, who was this little Scottish girl? Can you talk about how this led you to go to work at the University of California, Riverside?
Yeah, so I had started working on toxoplasma in the brain in Chris's lab, and he thought this is a great idea and this is a good niche for me. And he was, again, generous and sent me to this neuroimmunology conference, a FASIP summer conference. So I have this appearance of, you know, I have very good genetics. And so I look, you know, 12 years old, and I'm really very ancient. And because it was also a neuroimmunology conference, I had a lot of questions. I didn't know much neuroscience. I had a lot to learn. And so I asked those questions. And I really, really encourage any students that are listening that this is, and of course, any trainees, that you should, if there's a little question in your brain, it's probably in other people's as well, and that you should definitely ask your questions when they come up. And so I asked some questions that seemed to instigate a lot of discussion, and it attracted the attention of my now colleague and friend, Dr. Monica Carson, who's a microglia expert. And she also had the habit of sitting at the back of the conference room and proceeded to completely distract me and ask me what my plans were next, and told me that there was going to be a job posting and that I should apply. So that was another very fortunate point in my life. And when I was kind of very busy in my postdoc and I didn't quite get around to applying to this position. So she told me, you haven't applied yet, you need to apply. So she pestered me.
Well, that's very fortunate, both meeting her yes. and having her follow up like that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I was very lucky, and she's still very much a mentor today. She's the chair of our department. And once I arrived at Riverside, which was a great place, I left one of the best parasite immunology departments there are at UPenn, and where we all had, you know, these joint lab meetings, which were terrifying as a trainee, but really give this wonderful training in presenting and answering questions and thinking about science as a group. But by the end of, you know, 5.5 years, it might have, I could maybe predict people are going to ask about that flow cytometry plot, and they're going to say this and they're going to say that. And then moving to Riverside, there's a lot of neuro folk here, and they got so excited to hear about this parasite in the brain. That, I mean, that's just crazy. I didn't know about this. And they have developed lots of really productive and meaningful collaborations with neuroscientists that can help my science in many ways.
Well, at Riverside, the primary focus of your lab has been, as we have just started to discuss, the immune response in the brain following Toxoplasma gondii infection. I was recently listening to the podcast This Week in Parasitism. Now, the listeners may wonder, boy, Ken listens to some odd podcasts. But it's actually a fascinating podcast. And in the episode that I was listening to, Dixon Despommier and Vincent Racanello did an episode all about Toxoplasma gondii. In that episode, Despommier referred to Toxoplasma gondii as the most successful parasite on Earth. Can you give our listeners, who maybe aren't up to speed on T. gondii, sort of an overview of this parasite?
I completely agree with Despommier. I think Toxoplasma is the most successful parasite on Earth. It can infect any nucleated mammalian cell. And so it's a protozoan parasite. So it's also needs to be inside cells. So it's an obligate intracellular parasite. And the prevalence rates in the human population can range between 10 and 80%. So in the States, it again ranges between 10 and 30%. And in some places of Europe, for example, France and South America, like Brazil, they can reach up to 80% of people are infected with toxo. But as well as the human population, what also distinguishes it is its ability to live in any other mammal, of course, mice and cats, but also a scientist called J.P. Duby has sampled animals around the world, you know, black bears in Canada, and also free-range chickens, and everything is infected with toxin. So this ability to infect multiple hosts makes it very, very successful. And clearly it's in the human population, it is maybe an underappreciated parasite.
So you've kind of touched on this already, but a little bit of an expansion on it. In humans, it infects about a third of the world's population and infects 15 to 30% of the U.S. population. But in France and Brazil and other parts of Europe and South America, it infects up to 80% of the population, as you mentioned. For our listeners, can you please explain, or what do we know about why the infection is so much more common in Europe and South America than in the United States?
Well, as a European, I'm going to say it's not because we're dirty, right? But I think the eating habits have a lot to do with it. So in France, they really love their steak tartare, which I've actually had one outside the Louvre before. So undercooked meat is a big source of infection. The infective form, the tissue cyst, resides in the muscle and meat of many animals that we eat. And if we don't cook it properly, we're going to get infected. The other possibility is that the highly infectious form, the oocyst, is excreted by cats. So the feral cat population also is likely playing a huge epidemiological role in the differences in the prevalence rates in these different countries.
That makes a lot of sense. When you go to a restaurant in the United States and order steak tartare, one hopes that that beef has been frozen.
Right.
I understand that even mild freezing kills T. gundi, something like 40 degrees will do it. Is that about right, Emma?
Yeah, that's about right. And actually in the States, there's the amount of infection of cows is actually pretty low. The source of infection, I think, in the States is more likely to be lamb. So avoid your lamb tartars.
I was reading someplace maybe about a year ago that Eskimos, you know, they traditionally have a heavy raw meat sort of diet, that the infection rate there is near 100%. It seems amazing.
I actually hadn't come across that study. It's really interesting. And yes, it makes a lot of sense. I'm not sure how many of them have cats. So,
yeah, I think it's the meat.
Yes, I think it's all the meat.
How does the toxoplasma parasite prevent digestion or breakdown by a macrophage when it's engulfed? I'm wondering about how it survives this process.
Those are actually two very different things. So when we ingest toxoplasma, it's in the form of a cyst or an oocyst. So the oocyst is resulting from sexual replication in the cat, and the cyst is in any other mammal, and that's the stage that we eat. And so when we eat it, this cyst has actually got a pretty robust cyst wall composed of many different glycoproteins. And so that is preventing complete destruction. But in the gut, it releases parasites, so namely tachyzoites, and tachyzoites mean fast replicating. And these invade, again, any nucleated cell, and they're responsible for dissemination within the host, whereas cysts are responsible for dissemination between hosts.
Right.
And the tachyzoites will invade these macrophages, or even dendritic cells, or epithelial cells of the gut. And like many apicomplexan parasites, they have rupture proteins that manipulate cell signaling pathways. So as they invade, they secrete these proteins and inhibit the internal immune response of these cells to allow the parasite to replicate and replicate and then go out and invade the next cell. But really what it wants to do is to get to the tissue of the host that is going to be eaten.
Right.
And there it will form cysts that will then be digested once eaten.
It's an amazing tale, and we've only scratched the surface as we continue to discuss this.
In most cases of human infection, there are most often few obvious consequences of the infection, but it can lead to a variety of serious problems that include toxoplasmic encephalitis, which is a disease that can be fatal if left untreated. And in most adults, it does not cause serious illness, but it can cause serious problems in congenitally infected children, and it's also a devastating disease in immunocompromised individuals, so such as AIDS patients. Can you talk a little bit about the unfortunate consequences of infection, specifically in these types of cases?
Yeah, in children, it's devastating. So it's actually, I don't know if you've heard of the TORCH diseases, but the T of TORCH stands for toxoplasma. So it's a pretty significant congenital infection, and depending at what point the mother becomes infected, it can cause real problems for the child. It can lead to spontaneous abortion. It can lead to hydrocephalus, and it can also lead to epileptic seizures, mental retardation, retinal inflammation, and blindness. So it's not an insignificant infection at all, and that's why pregnant women should stay away from cleaning out the cat litter. In AIDS patients, this was one of the biggest instigators of toxoplasma research, with the realization that many people that had developed AIDS were entering, you know, the ER, they couldn't walk, they were having seizures. And that was the reactivation of those tissue cysts in their brain. So toxoplasma likes to form cysts inside neurons inside the brain if the immune response isn't there. And unfortunately, this, you know, almost a real life experiment, these people that developed AIDS leads to a reduction in their CD4 T cells and ultimately their CD8 T cells as well. So they're highly, highly immune deficient. And in the absence of these T cells, toxoplasma reawakens from the cysts and starts back into that fast replicating phase. So you get holes in your brain. And so that resulted in lots of research in the 1980s. People at Alan Sher Gazzanelli did T cell depletion in mice and demonstrated the same type of scenario. So fortunately, with better HIV therapy, this isn't something that occurs and is more treatable.
That's interesting. Following on this discussion of immune system, how does the immune system in an immunocompetent host keep the infection in check? And are there any problems associated with having this immune system chronically upregulating a immune response? One would think there'd be some risk of a negative consequence there.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And that's something that my lab here really focuses upon. So the quickest answer to that question is T cells, and the production of interferon gamma is absolutely critical in preventing the reactivation of these cysts and the destruction of brain tissue. However, how frequently those cysts reactivate normally is actually poorly understood. The cyst is a real nightmare to work on. There's, you know, it's in the brain. It's not very accessible. It's slow replicating. You don't get many cysts in a brain. So some of these questions are still being investigated. But the fact that you have this chronic immune response in your brain, I think, is very important. My neuro colleagues are astounded that we can get 2 to 4 million cells, peripheral immune cells, out of a toxoplasma-infected brain. And normally you wouldn't get any T cells in your brain. It's that immune privileged site. So the fact that we can get so many peripheral immune cells out of the brain is quite astounding. But as you allude to in your question, this needs to be very much controlled. So in the absence of IL-10 and IL-27 signaling, that immune response gets kind of runs away and causes immune pathology and will kill the host. So it's a very important thing to balance.
Fascinating. As we've briefly touched on, cats of all kinds are the only definitive host of T. gondii, as they alone can harbor the parasite during the sexual stages of infection. Cats eat mice, and mice, unfortunately, sometimes eat cat feces containing the aforementioned oocytes, and then poof, now the mouse is infected, and then the cat eats the mouse, and the cycle repeats. Since the parasite can only reproduce and complete its life cycle in the gut of a cat, it would seem the evolutionary challenge for this parasite is how to get back to the inside of the gut of a cat. And this is where the story gets even more amazing and interesting. Could you talk a little bit about this, in particular, how the parasite is able to change the fundamental fear response that a rodent naturally has to cats?
Yeah, this is fun and amazing. And parasites are very good at changing their host behavior. Their life cycle can be quite complicated. And really getting back to that definitive host is critical. So in the mouse, most of the infection is found in the brain. And there's debate about whether there's tropism for certain parts of the brain. But perhaps there is for the olfactory sites and for the amygdala that controls your response to behavior. But if you have an uninfected mouse and it smells cat urine, it will stand still or run away so it doesn't get eaten. That's good evolutionary behavior. But then if you have a mouse that is infected with toxoplasma, it runs directly towards the smell of the cat urine. And we've actually just replicated some of those experiments in my own lab here at UC Riverside, where we've put a piece of cloth soaked in cat urine, and the uninfected mouse has this freezing behavior. It's very, very noticeable. But then if you put an infected mouse side by side, this mouse will actually exhibit very similar behavior to being attracted to it. So we have a positive control, which would be mouse pheromones. And it picks up this cloth and has a good sniff and a nibble and plays with it and adores this thing. And the behavior is really striking. So how that actually happens is it could be a number of ways. It has been demonstrated that toxoplasma can produce dopamine, and that can regulate the behavior in these areas, in the olfactory areas. There's a lot of changes in neurotransmitters in general. So Ira Blader at University of Buffalo has also showed changes in the neurotransmitter GABA. And my work here at UC Riverside has demonstrated significant changes in the neurotransmitter glutamate. And how that changes the circuits of an infected brain is going to be really interesting. We see changes in things like dendritic spines, and the health of neurons is different. Where that inflammation lies will also be an interesting,
No, it's fascinating.
It's good.
Yeah.
You know, there's some amazing videos on the web of infected mice coming up to cats and rubbing themselves on the cat and climbing all over the cat. And the cat sort of has this look on its face like, this must be a crazy mouse.
Yeah. You know? I don't know if I want to eat this one or not.
Skip this dinner.
I had a flash to the Tom and Jerry cartoons. It's like all they had to do is infect them with T. Gandhi and
and they would be friends, right? No. I must also have a shout out for Laura Knoll, who is in Wisconsin and has just demonstrated why the parasite can only have sex in the cat, which is a really frequent question that all of us get. And it's really nice to have an answer that the cat is one of the only mammals that doesn't have this one amino acid. You know, these parasite life cycles are so finely tuned. It's really amazing.
It is.
Very cool. So as mentioned earlier, humans, unlike mice, are typically infected via intermediate hosts, so such as sheep, goats, pigs, when ingesting undercooked meat. So would you say that vegetarians are safe?
Unfortunately, vegetarians are not safe. Cat poo, cat feces gets everywhere, it turns out. So I've had cats all my life, so I'm not advocating their removal by any means. But there's a researcher at UC Davis, actually, that Pat Conrad, who's demonstrated that the amount of cat poo, infective cat poo in California is measured in the tons. And so if you, cats also like to sort of bury their waste. So if you're a gardener, wear gloves, wash your hands. When you're picking up your vegetables, make sure they're washed to avoid, you know, cat shit in your carrots.
This may explain a lot about California's current state of affairs.
I knew you were gonna say that.
That's so East Coast of you.
I have a quick aside. Just are there any, so, and you know, we always talk about like the relationship between parasites and their hosts. Are there any benefits of an infection that we've seen?
Well, there was a study recently that suggested people that go about the scary process of doing a startup company are more likely to be toxopositive.
Maybe I'm just trying to make myself feel better because I've always had cats, but
there's some of that. We don't know. I think in a human brain, the parasite is going to get lost. It's going to be less targeted. Mouse and human brains are very different. Mm-hmm. And where the parasite ends up could be a huge matter of chance as well, where it's taken by the bloodstream, what cells it ends up infecting. So I think it does have the potential to have good effects rather than just crazy effects. Yeah. There's also a possibility that this inflammation that it recruits to the brain has beneficial effects, although that might sound a little crazy. Things like Alzheimer's disease, dementia, are caused by a sort of buildup of protein that isn't cleared away properly. And so the peripheral immune response actually helps that.
So speaking of food, I suspect that we also have some listeners out there who are wondering about seafood. So can seafood lead to infection?
there have been reports that seafood can lead to infection. The ooze cyst is actually much more resistant to sort of desiccation and being in the water than we previously appreciated. And in fact, it's led to significant otter dissemination in the past in California. So we have to be careful of perhaps more of our raw seafood. But things like shrimp, calamari should be fine. But yeah.
Yeah, I've heard that the sea otters had a lot of problem with T. gondii and that it came from their abalone-rich diet and that the abalone had been infected. It's amazing how robust this parasite is.
Yeah, yeah. So there was legislation in California that stopped this flushable kitty litter because that ended up in the waterways and ended up to this massive infection of shell food. And
Following on the immunity theme that we've been discussing, there's no vaccine currently to prevent toxoplasmosis in humans. But that said, and you've touched on some of this, there are certainly some common sense preventative measures that spring to mind. You've mentioned pregnant women avoiding contact with cats, but there are a lot of other things. You mentioned wearing gloves when you work in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
Could you hit just quickly before we go on the other recommended preventative measures for our listeners that could feel better about reducing their chance of infection?
Yeah, wearing gloves, washing your fruit and vegetables, putting a cover over the kids' sandbox would be good as well. Cooking your meat thoroughly, those would all be precautions that I think most pregnant women are told to. When I was pregnant, I was told to not work in a toxoplasma lab, so that was a bit of a problem. But unfortunately, the best vaccine for toxoplasma is toxoplasma itself. And so we haven't generated anything else. But if you are previously infected with toxo, you actually have a much better chance of preventing transmission to the baby. So it's a thing called concomitant immunity. So if you're already infected, you're immune to subsequent infections. And so some people, in some countries rather, like France, it's almost mandatory to know your infection status.
Yes.
If you're of childbearing years.
Yeah, they test for it there.
Yes.
For pregnant women, very closely.
STEM Talk is an educational service of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, a not-for-profit research lab pioneering groundbreaking technologies aimed at leveraging and extending human cognition, perception, locomotion, and resilience.
Emma, you and a team of your colleagues at Riverside have been running tests on mice, which, like all mammals, are natural secondary hosts for Toxoplasma gondii. And you had a 2016 paper in the journal PLOS Pathogens that described how toxoplasma infection leads to a disruption of neurotransmitters in the brain. And you postulated that the infection triggers neurological disease in those who are already disposed to such disease. So can you talk about these tests and also the significance of your findings for this paper?
Yes, yeah, so there have been a lot of correlative studies suggesting that if you're infected with toxoplasma, you are more susceptible to neurological disease. And that might be including things like schizophrenia. And so my question was, well, how would that happen? And we wanted to look, in conjunction with my neuroscience colleagues, look at some more of the changes in neurochemistry that might be happening in that an infected brain, not just the immune response. A colleague, Todd Fiacco here at UC Riverside, is an expert in astrocytes, and he looked at some of these movies that I generated and looked at some of our EM at all these astrocytes that were incredibly swollen, very different morphologies. And he was kind of astounded that our mice were still alive. And this astrocyte reactivation is a big sign of pathology. One of the biggest roles that astrocytes play, as well as being able to do things that us immunologists think of, like produce cytokines and chemokines, they can also control the parasite. They are really important in regulating extracellular concentrations of neurotransmitters. So we measure particularly the neurotransmitter glutamate, which is the primary excitatory neurotransmitter in the brain. And astrocytes control that right at the synapse with a glutamate transporter called GLT1. And once a neuron fires its transmitter into the synapse, then if that glutamate wasn't cleared up, then there would be no signal-to-noise ratio, and the neuron would start to get almost, it would get overexcited, and it would become a pathological process. So we looked at astrocytes' ability to do this job, and we looked at the expression of GLT1, which is significantly downregulated following infection. We also measured, using microdialysis, the extracellular concentrations of glutamate and a bunch of other amino acids in the brain. And at chronic infection, so after about 3 weeks, the concentrations of glutamate go really significantly higher. And as a result, we think we have differences in the morphology and function of neurons. So we lose dendritic spines and the way that neurons essentially communicate with each other. And we also measured with my colleague Devin Binder here in the UC Riverside School of Medicine. He focuses on epilepsy. Actually, he runs his lab Monday, Friday, and takes out bits of brains from people with severe epilepsy Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So he's an amazing colleague to have. And we did EEG in mice that are infected and demonstrate that there's massive power loss in many of the circuits in the infected brain. So I think toxoplasma infection can have the potential to have a very specific effect on mouse behavior, right? It's designed almost to be to manipulate mouse behavior. So that's a very specific thing. But changes in neurotransmitters in the brain in general could have a much broader effect on people that are susceptible to, you know, perhaps genetically susceptible to neurological disease in the first place. And that might include schizophrenia. It might include other diseases like epilepsy.
So fantastic, Emma. And your paper from PLOS Pathogens in 2016 examining the effects of toxoplasmosis infection on the GLT-1 glutamate transporter only included female mice. So does the sex of the animal change the effect of the infection?
We've done both male and female mice. And I think that's really important. NIH has, for one reason, mandated it, because so many drugs are only tested in male mice, because they're easier to use, because they don't have these changes in hormones. So they're much more stable, debatedly. So we've done it in male and female mice. And we have also conducted these studies in resistant and susceptible strains. So we definitely see behavioral changes in male mice as well.
Thinking about the work you've done in the lab with mice, have you any thoughts on whether there might be differences related to how toxo affects animals in the wild? Or would you think it would be a straight-up model of how that would work?
I think it would be... Mice are very good at hiding. If you often see a mouse out in the wild, perhaps that one's the toxopositive one, the brave one. But it would be really good to do a big screen of all these genetic variations in mice. And, you know, colleagues, Peng Lok, for example, has done parasite infections in lots of different wild mice. And I think there's a lot to be learned from studies like those.
Yeah. I would think so. In terms of neurological disease, you previously mentioned toxoplasma's strong correlation with schizophrenia. And as I understand it, it's not that toxoplasma is the direct or only cause for schizophrenia, but rather that you believe the parasite's presence appears to be one of perhaps several precipitating factors. Could you talk just briefly about schizophrenia in the context of T. gondii?
Yeah, there has been strong correlation, and there have been studies done by Fuller Torrey and Rob Yolkin at the Stanley Foundation that have been instrumental in kind of driving a lot of this research. And they have looked at schizophrenics, and there is a strong correlation with toxoplasma infection. A recent study out this month, I think, looked at a cohort of 12,000 individuals in Denmark and over time. And again, that supported this correlation with toxoplasma and schizophrenia. But some of these neurological diseases, they can be, you know, a wide range of disease. What are we measuring? How do we know? It's more of a spectrum. But I think if the parasite is present in the brain, it could be a trigger for something genetically underlying.
So some parasitologists have said that toxoplasmosis infections in asymptomatic humans result in a silent partner that serves no role. Is this true, first of all? And what are the arguments for and against a role of toxoplasma infections in the health of an otherwise asymptomatic humans? And is it fair to say that the parasite is not as latent or even as dormant as researchers once thought?
Yeah. So the likelihood is that there aren't many cysts in the brains of toxo-infected individuals. In a highly infected mouse, you might get 3,000 cysts. And if you think of the millions and millions of neurons in a brain, the number of cysts in a brain are likely to be pretty low in a human brain. And most of the time, I suspect that infection is asymptomatic. And that's one of the really interesting things as well, that despite having a parasite in your brain, despite having all these immune cells in your brain, that you are clinically quite unaware of it. And so that would actually help us to understand what is a well-balanced immune response in the brain. And if we can understand those processes, can we apply them when there is serious clinical pathology in the brain? So, this 80% of people are infected in France, and they're not all crazy. They don't all have schizophrenia. The Scots and the French have a very close relationship, so I hope I'm not insulting anyone by saying that. No. The graduate student that did the GLT-1 paper is actually French, so I took advantage of that teasing as much as possible. And then if you look at a cyst, and say if you look at parasites that are dividing, those cysts are not necessarily dormant or latent. The parasites do still continue to divide. Sometimes you do see inflammation around a cyst. How often they are reactivating and when they are dormant, perhaps there's a lot more cyst heterogeneity than we appreciate, and whether in one host they have cysts that are more likely to reactivate rather than the other. That I think that is some of our future questions.
And on that note, do you think we should be looking at the effects of eradicating toxoplasma in asymptomatic humans? If so, do you have any thoughts on how this might be accomplished?
I think if you're asymptomatic, you should love your parasite. And the drugs that we have to get rid of toxo are actually pretty limited. We have drugs that will control the fast replicating phase of the parasite. But they're pretty nasty. They're sulfur-based and they're contraindicated during pregnancy. And we have no drugs at this point that really remove the cysts from the brain, which is, you know, a pretty high bar. You know, they're intracellular inside neurons. And normally, too, we don't really want to go in and kill too many of those infected cells. So I'd be reluctant to talk about eradicating anything, actually, but any organism. But to eradicate something in an asymptomatic individual could end up doing more harm than good.
There are some reports that humans that display risk-taking behavior are more likely to be infected with T. gondii. So this includes a higher likelihood of infection in those that die in motorbike accidents, as well as increased entrepreneurial spirit in students that are infected. So do you think there's enough evidence to suggest that T. gondii might alter risk-taking in humans?
I think we need a little more evidence, but anyone that does a bungee jump, I think, must be toxopositive. But I love the entrepreneurial spirit in students. I think that is a really interesting angle. There are consistent reports of this correlation with car accidents. I think there was another one with truck drivers as well. So I'm going to sit on the fence a little bit, to be honest. I don't think there's a huge amount of actual evidence. But there is increasing correlative studies. Yeah. Sorry.
No, it's interesting thing to follow down the line.
Yeah.
This has been with us a very long time. And one wonders if it could have potentially, I know this is a reach, but could have potentially encouraged some populations to be more explorative and to leave they were, you know, and move up into Europe or whatever the example is.
Right. I know somebody had to get on that canoe, right?
Who's
going to be that person that got in the canoe and kept paddling? Yeah.
Well, you know,
it wasn't going to be.
No, the person I would check for T. Gandhi is the first person to eat an oyster.
And then they got infected.
You got to check that guy out right away.
After the 2016 paper was published, you were quoted as saying that for the first time, it has been shown that the direct disruption of a major neurotransmitter in the brain resulted from an infection. As a result, you said more direct and mechanistic research needs to be performed to understand the realities of this very common pathogen. Is that what you've been working on since 2016?
Yes, we've actually been investigating the mechanism of GLT-1 downregulation. So we believe that direct infection by the parasite itself can manipulate the GLT-1 pathway. So GLT-1 is downregulated in many neurological diseases, not just when you get infected with toxoplasma. So my gut instinct was that it was more about inflammation, and it still may contribute as well. But we do have a lot of data now that demonstrates that toxoplasma, once it invades an astrocyte, which is also not extremely common, can lead to the downregulation of this transporter. So we've been working on that. We're also looking at the parasite is in the neuron at this time in the brain, but the conversation between astrocytes and neurons is absolutely fundamental to the regulation of neurotransmitters. And so GLT-1 gets upregulated in astrocytes when neurons fire a lot, because clearly there's more need for it. And so neurons are regulating the expression of GLT-1 on the astrocyte using exosomes. And we can see following infection of neurons and cyst formation in neurons that the exosome number and distribution changes. So we're investigating that astrocyte neuron conversation currently. Mm. And other people also, I must say that Ira Blader has shown changes in GABA, and there's been these changes in dopamine as well. So there's a definite consensus that neurochemistry in general is markedly different in the infected brain.
So traumatic brain injury, PTSD, and suicide are recognized as being significantly interrelated in active duty and veteran populations. Can you comment on the impact of T. Gandhi infection, altered response to physical and psychiatric exposures, and military-relevant neuropsychiatric illness?
Right, so the parasite, the infection itself, could have potentially a direct effect on how the brain responds to trauma. Perhaps it could have an effect on potentially the behavior of that individual to start with. But also, we can't forget that there are changes in the inflammatory response in the brain as well, thanks to infection. So whether that helps or hinders multiple insults to the brain, I think has to be worked out. So repeated hits to the brain, you know, is thought to lead to a very different response than just one TBI, for example. I think it's the conjunction between the possibility of direct parasite manipulation on neurons and their circuits that could lead to changes in behavior in response to trauma, in conjunction with the underlying inflammatory response that's in the brain. Yes, I believe it could very much change things. In fact, I should probably write some grants for the DOD.
In 2016, Sugden et al. Published results of a study looking at a cohort of, in their words, early middle-aged individuals that suggested that T. Gandhi infection does not result in increased susceptibility to neuropsychiatric disorders or to poor impulse control or impaired neurocognitive ability. In addition, they found no association between infection and aberrant personality types. Can you talk a little bit about this paper and perhaps talk about how and why its reported findings differ from other contemporary publications that one sees on the effects of T. Gandhi?
The Sugden paper has a cohort of approximately, I think, over 800 individuals.
Yes, that was right.
I think for every study that says there isn't a correlation, there's another study that says there is a correlation. My knowledge of that paper isn't huge, but again, I think one of the concerns about measuring these types of things is what's the readout? What's this? It's such a broad spectrum thing, this what's impulse control and neurocognitive ability. And again, there was another study recently by the group that's been studying this for a long time, admittedly. So this is a cohort of over 12,000 individuals, again, finds a correlation, but it's very specifically with schizophrenia and nothing else. Oh, there is a weaker correlation with traffic accidents. Yeah, and so I think the culmination of all of these papers suggests that toxoplasma does not cause schizophrenia, right? Because then the correlation would be so much stronger. I think there are likely multiple ways of getting such a rewiring, a disease that, again, that is hard to pinpoint the causes of.
It's got to be tough. And, you know, it seems like the time is ripe in this field for mechanistic studies trying to get beyond correlation. You know, you can, these correlation papers, I could write a paper saying that T. Gandhi is highly correlated with having a very good national soccer team.
Yes.
And it would be true.
that would be true. France is pretty good. And the male soccer team.
Brazil. Yeah, that's what we should write. In males.
Yes. NIH would love that. Yeah.
Then we could infect our crappy male soccer team with T. Gandhi and see how they
And that's how actually most people respond to those. First of all, that's the clickbait that would come out of that from the media.
Yeah. Exactly.
And then you have people running around wanting to
infect our soccer players.
They go cleaning litter boxes and eating cat.
Oh, the soccer players will clean the litter boxes.
Sorry. Emma, you were also collaborating with Michael White, who is from Florida and did a sabbatical in your lab through last year. The two of you are looking at cyst formation. Can you talk about that research?
Yeah, Michael is a parasite guy, and I'm a host person, and Michael's been interested in the regulation of cell cycle and many apic complexins for a while. And we've been focusing on cell cycle-regulated AP2 transcription factors, and we're interested in how these regulate the differentiation of these tachyzoites, those fast replicating, disseminating parasites, and how they switch into the bradyzoite or the cyst-forming parasite. And some of these transcription factors act to repress the bradyzoite rather than to promote a differentiation. So it's about suppression. And so he came to the lab, and I learned a lot more about cell cycle and cyst formation, and we're continuing to try and understand how those cysts are formed inside neurons versus other cells, and using some of these cell cycle manipulated strains. Of course, this is actually quite difficult because you start manipulating a parasite in vitro, then you get a very different animal than what is actually in vivo. So that's been a lot of work to try and get something that will actually make a good number of cysts to be worthwhile counting. As you start to manipulate these strains, they get lab adapted. So we're working on that just now.
In your wonderfully titled 2017 paper, Brains in Brawn, Toxoplasma Infections of the Central Nervous System and Skeletal Muscle, you discuss how toxoplasma infection can affect skeletal muscle. Can you elaborate briefly on this?
Yeah, toxoplasma likes to go not just to the brain, but also to the muscle, where it infects skeletal muscle cells. And Beth Wolfert at Buffalo and also Carson Luder have done some really excellent work on this, but it's kind of an underappreciated area, even though that's the most likely area that we're actually eating, where, we're eating the muscle of the beast. But pathology has always been targeted to the brain. And that's possibly because when reactivation occurs in the brain, you really notice it, right? Those clinical symptoms are hard to ignore. But perhaps if reactivation is happening in the muscle, you just ran too much the previous day, but you can get significant atrophy as well. So the immune response that's happening in the muscle is now being investigated more thoroughly. It's going to be really interesting.
And does this also occur in those who are asymptomatic?
Yeah, we don't know. In the mice, yes, we know that it happens in mice, but it's rare in those asymptomatic individuals. It's rare to look for toxoplasma. It has to be a reason for looking, and it's not considered.
That's another whole issue. If many of these effects, or even a couple of them, turn out to be strongly correlated and perhaps causally connected to T. gondii infection, then we might want to be looking at the population a little more closely for this infection.
Yes, and muscle atrophy or other aches and pains, you know, maybe toxoplasma could be a cause of that.
Sure.
One thing to sort of mention, though, is that you have to be really immune compromised for this parasite to reactivate. And what is more likely in these asymptomatic individuals is that there's a well-balanced response, both in the brain and the muscle, that is catching any reactivation that's going on and not causing pathology.
With the importance of both the quantity and quality of skeletal muscles, particularly in the aging population, and its importance for long-term health, you know, this is an interesting side angle. You know, this could be a real physical effect of the infection. That would be, I think, interesting to look at as well.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And again, totally, it's not even been broached yet. Yeah. It's a lot of work to do.
The relationship between host diet and T. gondii seems interesting to me. Are there opportunities to mitigate the impact of acute and chronic T. gondii infection via dietary manipulation or supplementation? In a 2016 paper published in PLOS One, a Chinese research team reported that T. gondii seems to, and this is their language, hijack host PPAR signaling pathways to downregulate the metabolism of fatty acid, lipids, and energy in the liver. One wonders if a ketogenic diet or supplementation with exogenous ketones might be therefore helpful.
Oh, that's, I hadn't come across that one. Yeah, that's very interesting. And that would be something that experiment that you described would be quite doable. And there's a lot of connection between the gut and the brain, right?
Yes.
Gut-brain axis. I have a colleague, Jujitsu Koss, here, also looks at the pituitary gland and how that regulates so much of our brain and inflammatory. We think of ourselves as immunologists or people that work on metabolism or neuroscientists. And all of these things don't sit in a box. They all regulate each other. And so I think it's important to look to different fields and see how they're connected.
Agreed. That line in the paper about T. gondii hijacking PPAR signaling is really interesting. That could connect not only to exogenous ketones, but also to the whole class of drugs that affect the PPAR pathway and PPAR delta agonists. So I can imagine that could be an interesting research topic.
Yes, I absolutely agree.
Beyond the science, and broadly speaking, the impact of T. gondii on international society and economics is still poorly understood. So where do you think T. gondii research should focus on in the near future?
There's considerable problems at the moment, and I think these are not going away anytime soon in South America, where we have strains of toxoplasma that are causing disease in immune-competent individuals. So we have three commonly referred to strains, type 1, type 2, type 3, and the type 1 is highly virulent, and we used to think of that as just being in the lab, whereas type 2 and 3 will cause cysts and cause chronic infection. But a type 1 parasite, one parasite is enough to kill a mouse. And in South America, we're getting these emerging strains that are very virulent. I mean, that's quite terrifying, and I think that needs to be addressed. So that, and there's a huge economic cost there. There's also more and more people are becoming congenitally infected. So this is not something that's, you know, going away or is controlled by any means. There's at least more recognition of congenital infection that causes blindness, as well as the more robust or tragic pathologies of children. So I think they need to be investigated. And hopefully some of the work that we do here Yusuru said, is maybe applicable to the neurological disease that is found in congenital infection rather than some of the more asymptomatic hosts. So that I think there's a lot to be done in that area. Hmm.
Shifting gears a little bit, there was a whole spat of stories a couple of years back. We've been calling them here as we prepared for your interview, the cat poo stories. But they were really sensationalized in the media, and they make for great clickbait. Mm-hmm. But what are your thoughts on the communication and interpretation of science of this kind, and as we communicate it in the public domain? As another example, we recently saw a prominent scientist saying that his research demonstrated that the consumption of meat was as dangerous as smoking, which of course is nonsense.
Yes.
What responsibilities do you feel that university press offices and sometimes the researchers themselves have in this whole process to communicate clearly without the hyperbolic sort of interpretation?
Yeah, so a really good point. And I think clickbait is a disease that is manifesting horribly in all sectors of society. It's so easy to turn things into a yes or a no or a black and white. And science is not like that. Science is much more interesting. And I think it's very hard to convey the complexity of some science. And I think as scientists, we need to play a role in that because that's where the interest is, right? That's where what's fascinating. If everything was so black and white or, you know, parasites make you crazy, it's not like that. And in fact, the nuance and the real interest underlie is where things are, you know, where you get to work stuff out. Why does it happen here and not there? And that actually gives it a much more broader context as well, not just during toxin infection, but other neurological diseases. So scientists and, of course, UC, all press offices should be aware of that and try and convey the interest.
Agreed.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly.
That kind of topic is one of the motivations for developing our show, STEM Talk, was to have a guest scientist and two other scientists that are in different fields have a reasonably in-depth conversation about the guest's research and not sort of mediate it through a journalist. And I think some people certainly appreciate that.
I certainly appreciate it. I think it's been a wonderful opportunity.
Emma, when you moved to Riverside, you decided that you were going to focus on work and you weren't looking to get into a relationship with someone. But when you weren't looking, and this often happens, you met someone who ended up becoming your husband. And now the two of you have a fairly busy household. Is that right?
So yes, pretty busy. I have two stepchildren, 19 and 16, and a 7-year-old and a 5-year-old.
Wow.
And two cats, which is are not my scientific subjects. But yes, it's a very busy house.
It might be bad to be Emma's cat, you know. the cat's thinking, she's looking at me funny.
Nova did a feature at one point also asking about toxo and my lab, and they came and filmed, and so my cat is actually on Nova, so I'm really proud of her. She's the best part.
That's awesome. And I understand that when you became pregnant, you had your husband change the cat litter, and that you had a couple of years of what you described as joyful relief. Is he still changing the cat litter is the major question here.
Yeah, what do you think? No. Yeah. He's not changing the cat litter.
Yeah, I kinda,
but my job is done.
I kind of knew the answer to that one.
Well, Emma, this has been a lot of fun, and I know that when you talk to people about the best way to avoid T. Gandhi, you advise them to cook their meat and wash their hands of vegetables. Do you have any last words of advice?
Yes, wash your hands and vegetables, but also, you know, I've actually had a lot of people contact me about being pregnant and being very worried about toxoplasma, and I like to say, you know, enjoy your pregnancy. Don't worry too much, because I'm sure the stress is worse than the possible infection with toxoplasma. So wash your hands, wash your vegetables, cook your meat, and enjoy.
Freeze your meat.
Yes, freeze your meat.
Well, thank you. This has been fascinating. We both Don and I enjoyed the conversation quite a bit.
I had a lovely time. It was great to talk to you both, and I hope other people are interested in the best parasite on the planet.
Also one of the scariest if it changes just a little.
Yes, yeah, we need continued research on this.
Clearly. That's right.
Absolutely.
From your lips to NIH's ears.
Yes.
Well, thank you, Emma.
Thank you, Don. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you.
It's been a great time.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
So I have to say that Emma's area of research is definitely unique, especially thinking about how these parasites could impact our overall brain health and wellness. So to get a little more insight into Emma, people should check out the links to her research that are found in the show notes for this episode.
Yes, her enthusiasm for her work really comes through when you talk to her. And I totally agree with her that bars are indeed very important scientific places where many fruitful collaborations have been launched.
Hear, hear. Amen. And if you enjoyed this interview as much as Ken and I did, we invite you to visit the STEM Talk webpage where you can find the show notes for this and other episodes. STEMtalk.us. This is Don Carnegie signing off for now.
And this is Ken Ford saying goodbye until we meet again on STEM Talk.
Thank you for listening to STEM Talk. We want this podcast to be discovered by others. So please take a minute to go to iTunes to rate the podcast and perhaps even write a review. More information about this and other episodes can be found at our website, stemtalk.us. There, you can also find more information about the guests we interview.